You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 12th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello, and welcome to edition 301 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be having a close-up look at drone warfare and asking, is the virtual battlefield an ethical place to be? Film director Tonya Hessen-Shai will be here to help us find out.
We're also going to be learning how to stir up a revolution with self-styled tyrant toppler, Sergej Popovich.
And we'll be getting that guilty feeling with John Frost, the former UK customs officer who seized everything from presidential jets to working tanks and even a live monkey stitched into a coat.
But enough about Rob Bound's duty-free shopping list. Steve Bloomfield will be here with all the stories that matter and some that don't, no doubt, for the week ahead. And we'll enjoy some music too. It's all right here. It's on the Monocle Weekly, and it's on Monocle 24.
What a week it's been, Andrew.
It's musical chairs in here, isn't it? Our poor audience, I don't know who's whether they're coming or going.
I can't feel sorry for them.
Okay, Robert Bound, let's do a look at where they are. Robert Bound is in Brazil.
Brazil,
he's doing a story about Brazilian media. That's what he says.
You know, you can never trust Mr. Bound.
Bit of winter sun?
Yeah, No. Seeing friends? No. No, you know, he's gone to do a big story, which no doubt he'll write up one day.
speaks the editor.
No, I'm being nice to him. And Steve Bloomfield's coming in this way. And little Danny Giacopelli, we didn't need his services this week.
It's a bit of a relief, frankly, isn't it?
Now, I know that you like being on the side of the desk, in the hot seat, as it were.
It's the chair of power.
Yeah, so we should explain. There's like a power seat, which... Oddly, I'm never really that bothered of sitting in. I kind of like to sit to the side.
At the head of the table.
You have taken Rob Bound's seat.
I feel there should be some sort of crown or cape, cloak of some sort. You know, more regal than that.
At least a clean seat, anyway.
That is deeply unsafe.
And then we have the other chair that will be taken by Steve Bloomfield. But you're in Rob Bound's seat,
exactly,
as it were.
Filling his blue suede shoes.
Yes, and his red trousers. His dangerous
his
red trousers.
Celebrated, internationally renowned.
His infamous red trousers.
Red trousers, yeah.
Now, you and me, we're off to have some custard tarts. We are going to Lisbon.
Now, this is exciting, isn't it, Andrew? Surely none of our listeners can have failed to notice that it's the inaugural Monocle Quality of Life Conference. But it's exciting when we're ticking the days down now.
So, I think it's 200 people in total would be sitting in the audience. And we have everyone from Martin Roth, who runs a V&A museum here in the UK, through to Eric Spiekerman, who's the famous typographer, Issei Weinfeld, Brazil's most famous architect, Taco Dibitz, who runs the Rijksmuseum in De Nederland. They're all coming.
It's amazing. What a lineup. And it's a day of sort of incredible discussion, quite dynamic. Maybe there'll be a bit of chance for a bit of light entertainment along the way.
And a bit of a knees up on the Saturday night. Imagine all them doing the conga.
The world's most exotic conga line.
I think it's going to be
a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
And we should also remind our listeners that they can tune in if they can't join us there in the flesh.
Yes,
they can tune in on Monocle 24.
On the Saturday,
from
9 o'clock in the morning, UK time, right through to the evening, you'll be able to hear everything live. We will then be making some films that will be available at monocle.com. So, if you can't be with us in person, tune in.
One of these other forums.
You just won't be able to have a bite of our tart.
That's all happening next weekend. Very exciting stuff. Andrew, I think we should get this show on the road. Shall we start with our colleague Steve Bloomfield?
Let's get him in.
Stephen Bloomfield.
Yeah, you've been begging for a jingle for long
I
enough.
Have.
Finally, you've got
Do you
a
like
bit
that?
Of a jingle.
That's about that. As happy as you've ever looked.
King of everything. It's not even rude.
I think it's
the first
like
jingle
that.
We've made for the show that doesn't insult somebody.
That's because they're normally made about me.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's why. But
obviously, Steve, you just command more respect.
Well, I mean, what can I say? That's going to be my new ringtone.
We were just talking about Lisbon.
Yes,
you're coming.
Can't
as well.
Wait.
You're doing some hosting.
I believe I am. Yes, I will be. I think you and I, in fact, are doing the final session.
We are
all about mayors and cities and leadership. With I think about half a dozen people with us at the same time. So yeah, I think there'll be lots of people
musical
with lots
chairs,
of views.
That one.
Yeah, that's going to be a good one.
Musical deck chairs.
Yes,
indeed.
Yes. There are proper deck chairs as well.
There are good deck chairs.
Anyway, more about
yes.
that.
Yes. No, I'm very much looking forward to it. You want some news, though?
Yeah, give us some news, mate.
Okay, right. that was a bit Aussie.
Yeah, a bit Aussie. Well, I could be a bit Aussie.
Okay, for no reason whatsoever. A bit of Australian. Right, so let's start with elections taking place in Sudan this week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they are happening. Presidential and parliamentary elections in Sudan. And everyone's favourite man accused of genocide, Omar al-Bashir, is standing and is almost certain to be re-elected. So that whole Save Darfur campaign worked well then.
Does he travel abroad?
Well, he travels to certain countries that have promised they aren't going to hand him over to The Hague. So
he has
yes,
holidays with Mr. Mugabe and things like that?
Basically, yes. Okay. Yeah, limited to certain countries in Africa and the Middle East. It is, I mean, it's sort of one of the things we talked about on the Foreign Desk actually a week or so ago, one of the ironies.
Here he goes, getting another plug in for the show.
I'm just saying, you know, it's one of the ironies of the sort of the International Criminal Court charging him with genocide is that now he realises the only way to avoid going to The Hague is remaining in power. He can't step down for fear of actually his successor saying, actually,
stays in power in perpetuity and he's fine.
Yeah, yeah, because there's no one who can touch him.
But unintended
were he to step down, his successor might think, you know what, let's get some brownie points from the West and hand him over. Anyway, so that's what's happening this week. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. Our friends in Sweden at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as we know and love them, SIPRI, are releasing their annual yearbook tomorrow on world military expenditure. So this will be, there'll be a lot sort of going through the figures and seeing how much Russia's spent. Also, at the moment, in NATO, all the NATO countries have said they'll spend 2% of their GDP on defence.
But nobody actually quite does it.
No
they?
One actually
virtually
does it.
Yeah,
America
nobody.
Does it. Britain sort of does it if you sort of look a bit squinty-ish at the figures. You know who does, weirdly, in Europe, 2.5% GDP on their military? Greece.
Well, that's a surprise. Why do they do it that?
Is. Look at the trouble that's got them into.
Well, exactly. So there we are. Anyway, so there will be, I'm sure, in fact, we'll probably, in fact, tomorrow morning, I'm sure have someone on from SIPRI going through those figures. Do we want a bit of a Prime Minister's visiting places?
Well, if it's an interesting one, do
it's
one.
An interesting one. Narendra Modi. Yeah. He's on his travels. He was in France at the end of this week, just gone. He's going to be in Germany today and tomorrow. Not going to the UK.
No, but I've heard this is not apparently. We shouldn't read too much.
No,
into
no, no.
It's because we can't do much for them in respect of major manufacturing or nuclear facility development. Instead, no. he's winging it over to Canada.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Chatting with Harper.
And finally, I say finally, there might be another one after this. But Tom Edwards, there was a story which we almost dispatched you off to do.
Oh yeah,
wasn't there? In North Korea.
Oh, is this
the
Pyongyang Marathon?
The Pyongyang Marathon takes place today.
Oh, I feel like I should have been there.
I feel like you should have been there too.
That's just because you wanted to pack me off there and have me never come back.
And they didn't let anyone come from abroad on the excuse of Ebola, did they?
Originally they said, so last year they had foreigners for the first time. Although apparently last year they also had a problem that only as they were driving people to the start line on the bus, they said, by the way, you've got 4 hours. If you can't do it in 4 hours, I'm afraid that's it. Game over. And also it turned out they didn't have any water on the route as well. So there were...
Although, did you see the Qatar Marathon?
Yes!
They didn't have enough people, so they bussed in migrant workers, many of whom were in their flip-flops.
And made them run.
They were like, okay, mate, if you want to keep your job, you come in your flip-flops. So these poor kind of portly people were kind of waddling around in their flip-flops in the sun with no water.
Dear me. That's not very nice, is it?
No, it's not. It's
well,
not.
Maybe next year, Steve. I'm ready. Or if you can find another more exotic one.
Eritrea?
No. Eritrea for what?
A marathon? I don't know. They must do. No, you know what they're actually really big on is cycling, Eritrea. I know I said finally, but I do have one final one.
Okay.
Tomorrow, National Scrabble Day. you two, you know, strike me as Scrabble.
I love Scrabble.
Aficionados, yeah.
I love Scrabble, but I hate playing with people who make up these stupid two-letter words all the time. I don't like people being too clever about it.
You need to have a rule at the start that you've got a dictionary. There's one dictionary which you're going to use. If it's in there, fine. If it's not, not.
Yeah, but I still don't like it when people know all the Scrabble words. It's irritating.
Or the worst thing is when people make up words and they look in the dictionary. It's like, oh, look, it is a word. B-E. No, B actually is a word, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't mind swear. I don't mind swear words. That's quite good. But no,
maybe obscene Scrabble would be the way.
Obscene
to go.
Scrabble.
Obscene Scrabble. There we are. What I don't understand is why National Scrabble Day taking place on a Monday.
How many
when
points
at
bottom?
Work? B. Is it two for a B?
I don't know.
Okay, we'll work that out. You know what? I think Tom Hall, your intrepid producer, might find that out before the end of the show, so you can sort of announce it at the end.
Anyway, we love Scrabble. But thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you for my
jingle. King of the news.
Yeah. I think it was, wasn't it? He's brilliant at everything.
No, wasn't he brilliant at everything? I think, wasn't it, he thinks he knows everything.
Yeah.
No. It's definitely right.
That's more likely.
He's great at everything.
Let's anyway. let's play him out. Thank you very much, Steve Bloomfield.
Our first guest on today's show is the Norwegian filmmaker Tonje Hessen-Schei. Drones and their uses ranging from possibly delivering your Amazon parcel to secret surveillance and dropping bombs in war zones are becoming an increasingly common part of our world. But the long-standing debate about the ethics of their use is not going away.
Is it right to engage in warfare from the safe and comfortable confines of a remote control station hundreds or thousands of miles away from a chosen target? One person looking to try and answer this kind of question is the filmmaker Tonje Hessen-Schei, whose new documentary Drone looks at the detachment of drone pilots from the environments they wreak havoc on, and also focuses on the impressionable young pool of video game trained talent destined to create body counts in the hundreds. Tony, perhaps to get started, the question of drones, it's been controversial for some time. People have been charting the development of this sort of new, I guess, a new sort of front in the so-called war on terror. Why did you feel that the time was right to tell the story in the way that you did? Was it an accumulation of evidence? Was it the fact that you'd managed to get some pretty amazing access to some pretty amazing people? What was the key driver?
Well, I've been obsessed with the issue of drones for quite some time, and I was really shocked to see how Obama went from the promise of closing down Guantanamo to just killing people and thousands of people outside of declared war zones with no transparency and no accountability, and then the rest of the world, and especially Europe, just being silent on this issue. So for me, I thought it was very important to get the information out there and to tell the human stories from what is really going on.
Now, one of the things you look at is how many of the people recruited to do this fighting, to use the drones, to be at the control centres, which are often thousands of miles away from the people being targeted, that they came from, you know, computer games backgrounds. They were taking advisors and things from other fields. Did that surprise you?
Well, I got the idea for the film when I came across the story of a gamer who dropped out of high school and joined the military and very quickly, because of his gaming skills, was put to be a drone pilot. And to me, the very close relationship between the military and the entertainment industry was very concerning and fascinating and scary at the same time. But to see how the military used the same kind of interface and the same kind of joystick in this, and the thought of kids going from getting points per kill to actually killing real people on the other side of the world was very, you know, I mean, it's just the mindset really is very frightening to me. But, you know, gamers have incredible skills. Now, gamers are not the perfect drone pilots, it shows out, because being a drone pilot is incredibly boring. So they're really trying, or they're struggling very hard to find, you know, what makes a perfect drone pilot. And gamers might, after all, not be the perfect candidate for that.
There is some amazing testimony I mentioned at the top within the film from indeed former drone pilots who've recorded, you know, huge numbers of targeted strikes. Brandon Bryant, who actually at the beginning of the film says he never understood what it meant to kill. And then they had this sort of terrible dawning realization. In the film, it reflects very effectively this sense of realization that some people have had who've been involved in this. Is there a fundamental problem, though, that a lot of the people who are actually making the decisions, calling the shots, literally in some cases, they've not had that wake up? And do you hope that the film can maybe help to inspire that in those people?
Yeah, I think that it's very important for us to look at what it means to kill this way. Killing through joystick is a new development in warfare, and I think we haven't fully thought about the consequences of what this means. I mean, in one sense, you are taking sacrifice out of killing when it comes to drone pilots, yet they have a very different sacrifice when it comes to their psychological, well-being, and the post-traumatic stress numbers are, you know, pretty surprising. But if you think about it, the drone pilots really get to know intimately the people on the ground. They observe them for months and get really close to some of the people that they're then ordered to kill. And working so closely with Brandon especially really has taught us a lot about what it means to be a drone pilot and the consequences that killing through joysticks actually has.
I guess one of the central points in your film and one of the central concerns with this is the notion that people are desensitized. Or there's a distance that means that you're not that connected with your target. But what's fascinating is what you're highlighting is that I guess that we have this perception that people are desensitized, that they're disconnected from in this kind of killing. But when you see your film and when you hear you talk about it, are you saying that actually in the end these operatives do have a price to pay, that the killing that they had done will come back to them in some sense?
I definitely think that killing with joysticks is much harder than we have originally maybe thought. It's not like a video game, and it does have severe consequences on the human mind. Now, killing is a horrible thing, and it has consequences if you're on the ground or if you're behind a joystick. But it is a new way. There are new consequences that I just feel that we don't know what are. So in some sense, you know, the drone pilots are sort of part of this experiment. And it is also, you know, working with Brandon especially and hearing like how he feels that it is way too easy to kill this way. And also how every kill that is happening in the drone operating room is celebrated in this way by the people that give the order to push the buttons. So there's a disconnect between, you know, the people that give the orders and the drone pilots actually have to bear the burden. So I think that, you know, I mean, for me, drones sort of just slipped in the back door and became this new normal with us not having the proper debate about what does this really mean, not only for, you know, warfare and the future of war maybe, but also for, you know, the people and the drone pilots that also push the buttons.
But do you know, just come back on you, so in the UK, for example, we have so many soldiers who have come back from Afghanistan, you know, limbs missing, blown up, you know, in Helmand province, for example. Now, many of their families would say, well, if there was really a job to be done against, you know, Al-Qaeda operatives, against the Taliban, surely it would be better to use drones and put our guys on the ground, who, you know, sure, they may understand more the significance of what they're doing, but there is, you know, if this is definitely a job that needs to be done, it's better that they were sitting in a cosy operating room at a Royal Air Force base in the UK. In your mind, do you think that drones are not acceptable, or do you feel that we just need more debate and understanding about their use?
I am not anti-drone by any means. What we are looking at in the film is the use of drones, especially by the CIA, where you have a secret war with no transparency and no accountability. And what I really want to, you know, put a focus on is what kind of example the US is setting for the rest of the world, where you are all of a sudden killing people outside of declared war zone, and all of a sudden the whole world becoming a battlefield. And I think it's very important to step back and look at how the example that the U.S. is setting right now and the weapons we have today are just the beginning. That is my main concern, is what kind of standard are we setting for other nations? I mean, today you have 100 other countries that have the capability or are developing the capability of military drones. So how then, you know, what kind of standard are we going to have, and what kind of war do we expect that, you know, we will have in the future? And what kind of weapons are being developed? I mean, all these are issues that I don't feel that, especially here in Europe, we are not having a proper debate on.
Tonya, it's interesting that even amongst the military, there seems to be some divergence of opinion, difference of opinion. One of the sort of former military types who you speak to in the film talks about how there was this traditional warrior ethos that was being eroded by drones. And in fact, he seemed to be very uncomfortable about it. One always imagines the military would welcome this for the reasons Andrew said. It's very surgical. It keeps your guys safe. But actually, some of the military themselves are uncomfortable at the loss of that traditional, I guess it's a value structure that a lot of military personnel would have had traditionally.
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at a lot of people that join the military, go in, you know, to make the world a better place and to secure, you know, our freedom and so forth. And for Brandon in particular, I mean, Brandon was very patriotic when he joined the military and also very personally religious. And for him to see how the drone program operated and what they were actually doing and what this cost in the long term basically made him realize that he didn't feel like he was a warrior. He felt like he was a coward. And I also think that, you know, the stories that he told from the inside of the drone program, this rings true for a lot of them. They don't feel like warriors. They don't feel like what they're doing is valuable in the sense of being in the military. And if you look at how hard it is for the U.S. Air Force to actually get people to join the drone program and to keep the drone pilots in the program, this is definitely something that I think is true.
Do you feel that also, it always strikes me that this debate about drones, you know, and both of us have set it up as a surgical operation, but in fact what we see, especially in Waziristan, is that very often the people killed and not the actual intended target, you know, that the collateral damage, the taking out of families and kids is just part of the process. And I presume that begins to also undermine, you know, for people like Brandon, that there's a realization that this is not the clean surgical strike that you'd hope it to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially in the States, the drone is sold as this perfect weapon in the war on terror because it's so surgical and precise. And we don't hear about all the civilians that are killed. We don't hear about the whole families that are taken out or, you know, the neighbors. And I think, you know, Colonel Wilkerson in our film says this so brilliantly. He's like, you know, how can we win this war if every time we take out four, we create 10? So I think that, you know, the drones are sold as this perfect, quick solution, but I don't feel that the long-term consequences have been taken into account.
Tonya, perhaps just finally, can I ask you, I mean, the film is clearly very well-intentioned. It asks a lot of these very difficult questions. Do you think it can gain traction amongst those communities that you're talking about within, I don't know, even the halls of the CIA, this sort of thing? Do you think it's this sort of film that can actually make a difference, that will make people ask those difficult questions? Or do you still feel as a filmmaker and as a sort of journalist that you know, that those are people who will never really be reached?
That's a very good question. I have been very surprised by the overwhelming response we've gotten from the film. From school screenings to actually screenings for the military in Norway. And what I feel, you know, some of the common threads of people's reaction to it is that this is an issue that people do not know enough about. And it's something that we need to focus on and start discussing before it's too late. So I am hopeful that we will reach, you know, especially a large US audience.
Let's hope so. Tonya, thanks very much for coming to tell us all about it, and good luck. Let's wish you all the best for the continued success of the film.
I'm now going to be Rob, because Rob normally introduces the music, but it's my turn, and this is some brand new music indeed. This is The Doldrums from Seattle with Funeral for Lightning.
That was Seattle's Doldrums with Funeral for Lightning from new album, The Air-Conditioned Nightmare. Had a few of those in my time. We'll be talking, Andrew, to a self-styled revolutionary next on The Weekly, right after this.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
The fall of Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic in 2000 was the combined result of many factors occurring during the tumultuous 1990s in the former Yugoslavia. A Serbian society re-established its identity.
One of the crucial components in the downfall of the leader was Odpor, which is Serbian for resistance. The student movement, whose use of humour and non-violent techniques rather than aggression, was instrumental in causing a relatively peaceful transition of power. Sirja Popovic was one of the leading members of the organisation and has gone on to form the Centre for Applied Non-Violent Action and Strategies, better known as CANVAS, dedicated to providing resources for oppressed peoples to find their voice.
Popovic has a new book, Blueprint for Revolution, How to Use Rice Pudding, Lego Men and Other Nonviolent Techniques to Galvanise Communities, Overthrow Dictators or Simply Change the World. And he joins us now to tell us a little more about it.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the first question is that, you know, the reason for this book. Is it because you feel that there are many kind of campaigners, people hoping to make social change, that are a little bit misguided, that they need a rule book almost?
Well, I mean, this is my personal experience in working with the activists across the globe, is that, you know, every single situation is different, but there is a set of rules. And if you can put and pinpoint that set of rules, you will make the people's life easier. Another reason is that because throughout the research and work with the groups from across the world, I realized that it's basically hobbits, the common people. So it's like there is this power of the revolution which happens first in your head when you go into the process of social change. And I just felt like sharing this with the world.
Sergio, can I ask you then, once you get involved though with writing a book and then you're dealing with, you know, publishers and it becomes a, you know, a commercial enterprise as well, can that prove a hindrance to the core message, if you see what I mean? Does it become problematic in the same way that if you're involved with external agencies to help finance these sorts of things, some people will say, look, that becomes different, then there are commercial imperatives involved as well. Can it harm the message? Is that a careful line you have to walk?
Well, I mean, it's like this is not the first time we published a book, and basically my organization CANVAS works on printing the manuals, which are downloadable for free from the people across the world, translating it into different languages. So it's more like spreading the word than giving people free skills and knowledge. And when it comes to this book up to now, my experiences are great because I've done something that the authors rarely do. I left an email at the end. So I wanted to see the ecosystem the book is hitting. And I'm getting fantastic mails from high school students in places like Argentina or Mexico, who bought it through Amazon, to the real social change agents, serious people here in the Great Britain. So I think the book is reaching the right audience. I can't really tell. In commercial ways, I don't know. You need to ask my publisher.
Now, your role and the role of Odpor in the downfall of Milosevic is well documented and completely undeniable. And there were many things that kind of that are very important, I think, about what you did. You know, you had stamina, you had wit, you knew how to persuade other people to come on board, you knew how to outwit the dictatorship. But we're seeing many other campaign groups, you know, flourish with extraordinary momentum and then fade very quickly, either because of a lack of organisation or an unwillingness even to have any organisation, or because they come up against a much more gruesome foe. So in the beginning of the book, you reference Occupy, a movement which has kind of come and gone, and has it achieved anything? And you also have been working with the Syrian opposition, where, you know, they have come up against both IS, Assad, and have failed to kind of win through. Do you feel the lessons you had were very local, or do you really feel that you can pass these messages on to, you know, the likes of people fighting Assad?
Well, I mean, the basically what science says is that throughout the last 106 years, out of 320 different campaigns, you have twice more chances to win if you're using a nonviolent struggle. And looking at these experiences, and we try to be scientific, I mean, but we are more experiential here, you're looking at the sets for success. And you need to understand that every single context is different, but all the movements which worked from Gandhi through Martin Luther King and Lech Walesa in Poland and later Harvey Milk, they all shared the same things. They had a common vision. They built up the strategy. It was not a spontaneous thing. They were building through the small steps. They were capable to build up the unity, and they were capable to maintain the nonviolent discipline. So whether this every single situation is different, the success of movements which succeeded is related to the same thing. In the same time, I think the big challenge is, as you asked, how do you really fight like non-state actors like ISIS through the nonviolent struggle? How do you fight their narrative? And I think there is a lot to be learned also why this movement failed. How did you get such a tremendous uprising against Mubarak with such a little follow-up? And we try to pinpoint the problems of these movements and how to avoid these problems. We're not really trying to give a recipe because there is no universal recipe, but we at least try to help people who want to change the world to learn from other people's mistakes rather than making their own.
But just picking on that example of, you know, Tahrir Square, is it your feeling that they, and many people would feel that that movement has lost in a real sense, you know, that they have a new military dictatorship in essence. Do you feel they lost because there was violence, because they didn't maintain just a, you know, peaceful opposition? And also, I think your book highlights the need to have kind of follow through. You need to, even when you think the big game is won, you need to be dogged in continuing. Why do you think that an organization or a movement like that did falter?
Speaking of Egypt, it's a great and very sad example because some of my friends from April 6th movement are still in jail. I think there are several mistakes they made. First of all, they proclaimed the game over too early in a game. And like in a video game, you know, to get to game over, you need to go through the several levels. Second, I think more important, if you're building the movement around the values like democracy in Serbia or peace with neighbors in Serbia, instead of just dismantling Milosevic and Mubarak, you're far more likely to end up with a successful transition, because these values become something which is owned by the society, where if you just replace one leader with another, it's very likely that these other leaders will find the shoes of previous leaders comfortable. Last, as you said, you need to learn how to follow up the successful revolution with a successful transition. And that can be tricky, especially if we are talking about the societies where you don't really have the institutions. And only the building of the institutions guarantees you this kind of stuff. So I think the grand lesson, not only for activists who are planning this kind of major social changes, but also for decision makers and international communities, we need to help these people. You can't expect, you know, institutions falling from the sky in places like Egypt or Yemen. Yes, they can be very successful in mobilizing people against the bad guys, but what come next, they need the support for this.
Sergio, can I ask you about that then? Because obviously the sort of subheading of the book is how to use rice pudding, Lego men, other nonviolent techniques. And Andrew's already talked about this idea of wit, and it's clearly important to have that on your side. But like institution building, it's not so sexy, is it? It's not as exciting as a revolt. Is that one of the problems, do you think? It just doesn't engage people in the same way as that moment of revolution, that spark of change. This more procedural, more mundane business, if you like, of institution building just doesn't inspire people in the same way.
It is the part of the truth that, you know, building the institutions is less sexy than protesting the bad guys. But I think one of the things the book is particularly dealing with, as you say, is witting and humor. And it may be coming from my very Monty Python type of background, because Monty Pythons were very popular in Serbia and when I was growing up. And yes, humor has a power over the fear, and humor has a power in mobilizing people, and humor has a power in making our movement cool, and humor also has a power teasing people in power, because they believe in big picture of themselves and they often make mistakes. But humor can have a power in breaking down the apathy, which is the main status quo even in democracies. And I think keeping your politicians accountable is a very important part of democracy building. Aside of what you mentioned, building institutions is important, but having in mind that you are paying these guys to do the service, and if they do lousy service, it's your job, responsibility, and right to mock them, you know, to provoke them, to make them do the job. I think this type of mental revolution is what brings democracy to the society, as well as building institution is what brings democracy to the state level of the society.
On that point, can I just ask, you know, did you hope that, you know, Odpur would become, you know, successful political party. I know that there was a hope that it would maybe transform that way. And it certainly has a great legacy, and the work you're doing now is part of that legacy. But what's intriguing is it is very difficult sometimes for these revolutionary movements, these protest movements, to put forward political leaders that once they start taking responsibility, the shine comes off. You know, we look at someone like even like Lech Walesa. You know, yes, he ran an amazing organization, but then it turned out he was a bit homophobic and sexist, and his Catholicism controlled him in a way that other people found uncomfortable. You look at even like someone like, you know, Václav Havel, an amazing, amazing man, but in power had to start taking the grubby decisions of power. Do you feel that in a way being the protest movement is the glory bit? And you're bound to come unstuck if you start actually governing.
Well, I mean, you're right. And this is a big topic, especially when you're looking at all of these anti-systemic movements turning into more or less effective parties in places like Greece or Spain. And I think it's a question for 21st century. My personal experience was that I don't really think that it was important what happened with the organization of the movement like Otpor. I think that it is... three groups of idea of freedom, meaning free media, free and fair elections, freedom of assembly, idea of getting into EU, and most of all, idea of stopping the stupid ethnic wars, which Milosevic started, and living as a good neighbors with Croats and Bosnia. These three ideas prevail in Serbian society. Whether the Otpor would be the group to execute power at the end, or get corrupted by the power, if you like, to use another opportunity, it's less important for me. As living in Serbia, I'm super happy that this idea prevails to the point that the former Milosevic allies who got elected in power 2 years ago are now employing the same ideas we were fighting for. So these ideas became the part of the Serbian mainstream, and you can't get elected kind of thing if you're anti-European in Serbia. I think this is the big achievement. In this situation, thinking about what would happen to the movement may be important from the point of somebody who participated, but it's of less importance for me than what it really happens with a society.
At the end of the book, you have a paragraph which says, you know, watch out, people will accuse you of being stooges, of being funded by the opposition, even being a spy. And that did slightly happen to you. There were some claims around funding of your organisation and even some correspondence with a lobbying group called Stratfor that put the heat on you for a moment. When you look back at that period, do you feel that there were any mistakes made, or do you feel that that was just critics trying to get at you?
Well, I don't even think it's a critic, so I think it's a wrong narrative. And basically it's coming from Russian being afraid after Georgia and Ukraine and inventing this label, which we all used after years, which is colored revolution. Like, the revolution is something you can carry in a suitcase. So all you need is a few million bucks, two very skillful Serbs. You send them to the place X, boom, before you know there is a million people in a street. That's a nice narrative, and it fits nice in a conspiracy theorist environment. The problem with it, that is not true. In order to be successful, these struggles should be homegrown. They should be built around the local vision of tomorrow. Numbers should be built locally. Can you imagine a Serb taking out a million Egyptians? This is not realistic. I'm the person who would be the happiest in the world if this narrative is true, because the world would be democracy in a range of few years and few million pounds. But unfortunately, you need a different type of stuff. So external players can play the good roles, and they can help with skills and knowledge. They can also play the bad roles and, you know, funding opposition within the country, trying to influence them, trying to micromanage them, or bombing the country, which was the case we had in Serbia, can really harm your position and can help the bad guys. So we need to look at the role of external actors.
There was some funding from outside.
Absolutely.
And do you feel that, looking back, that if you're going to do that, you need to be more, you know, yeah, it's a fast-moving game, but you need to be more crystal clear about that at the moment and say, look, we are taking outside help.
I think whatever you say or claim or do, you will be labeled as a foreign mercenary and as a terrorist and as a crook, and sometimes even as a junkie in case of Serbia, because what your opponents will try to do, they'll try to create a social distance. Like, you know, this is us and this is them. And what they're particularly good at, in believing in their own propaganda. And their own propaganda says, no, the people won't be angry at me. It's only because somebody else is paying them to do this kind of stuff. And we're witnessing tons of this propaganda coming from outlets like Russia Today and becoming a kind of political mainstream. Like, you don't believe that people are clever enough to really protest a person like Putin, or they really need to be manipulated. So I think it's a part of the narrative. Personally, I don't think the groups should really rely too much on the foreign help, but it is only because I don't think the foreigners don't know. I think the groups know better, and whatever comes out from the struggle, it's more like the group's credit than the credit of whoever supports it.
Sergio, I think we're going to leave it there. The book is Blueprint for Revolution by Sergio Popovic. Sergio, it was great to meet with you and fantastic to speak with you about the book today. Thanks for coming to see us.
What makes for a good piece of chocolate? From minimal to maximal, Monocle Films meets the melters and the sculptors reshaping our chocolate expectations.
Having a culture that's so vibrant and lively and just colorful, I thought of incorporating the flavors of our background into the chocolate. So we use a black salt that's from the Himalayan mountains. We use rose water. We use coriander, fresh coriander seeds that are roasted into our caramel.
Our little cinematic ode to chocolate is now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Crossing borders is the essence of travel, but it can also be a slightly fraught affair for those who might have forgotten that stuffed alligator buried in their suitcase, or even worse.
John Frost spent many years on the front line of UK customs, both as a uniformed officer and as an undercover operative. And it means his wealth of stories of ill-advised imports, ranging from a suitcase full of human hair to presidential aircraft and every drug known to man, is a gift that just keeps on giving. He's written a book about it, Anything to Declare, The Searching Tales of an HM Customs Officer. And Tom Edwards met him a little bit earlier to confess all.
Obviously, the book is packed with amazing sort of anecdotes and stories and recollections, which we'll talk about. But just sort of, it's maybe useful to find out about the man behind the book, if you like. I mean, what's your sort of potted history, your own sort of biography, if you will? How did you come to be writing this book with all these extraordinary stories? What's been your journey through some of the roles that you, from which these stories are inspired?
Well, I'm sure that, like most people, it's one of those jobs that everybody's always wanted to do. And just as I was finishing college, somebody said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, to tell you the truth, I have no idea. And they said, well, I just happened to be in customs and excise, and we're looking for officers, the then Stansted Airport. They're doing interviews. And I thought, do you know, it's happened. The potential of doing the job that everybody wants to do has come up. Put in an application, and within a month I'd had an interview, and within a month after that I was I started uniform training. Spent probably 5-6 years at the airports, that's Stansted, Gatwick, Heathrow, and Manchester. And then I was lucky enough to be plucked to go into the investigation division, as it was then, which is all the undercover and surveillance side. From then on to do undercover work with Arctic lorries full of drugs as members of a gang. After a couple of years of doing that, I moved abroad to work with foreign agencies on behalf of the British government.
John, it's funny you mentioned that idea about a job everyone wants to do. I think, and again, this is sort of referred to in the book, there's that feeling when you walk through customs, return frequently from travelling, holidays, whatever. When you walk down that little corridor under the green sign, I'm always acutely aware of that feeling that I'm being watched. And you get to that, I don't know whether it is, you start to feel guilty when you have nothing to feel guilty about. Is that by design? Is that a product of the environment and you and your colleagues? You've created an atmosphere.
Absolutely.
Where people feel scrutinised. And I'm sure that you're very happy that they do feel that way. But why do you think people feel, I don't know, under that sort of pressure? I've become aware of how I'm walking in a way that I never would normally.
Well, I think it initially came in 1974. It was called canalisation, the red and the green channel as it was then before the blue was brought in. Prior to then, everybody was stopped. They had their bags checked and they had a white chalk mark made on it. But of course, more and more aircraft, more and more passengers entered the UK, things had to change. So in 1974, they brought in canalisation. And it was, as you said, specifically designed to make people feel nervous. If you can do that, if you can make what we would say the have-a-go smugglers feel nervous, then they won't smuggle. Then you're left with the hardcore, who, by hook or by crook, will try and get stuff into this country.
Well, we'll talk about them in a minute, but just in terms of that idea about the have-a-go types, how often do they end up giving the game away? I mean, there's a couple of examples. I think it's one of your early sort of drugs busts where people just have no, they've got no cover story at all. Or that, I think there's one where It says, I met a man in a pub. Where does he live? London. It's not a big place, is it? I mean, how often do people bury themselves, basically?
The ultimate man in the pub. How many times have I sat in an interview and heard, I talked to the man in a pub? If we could find that man in that pub, we would stop most of the crime in the UK straight away. There were have-a-go idiots, as you might have seen in there. There was a thing called Juju, which, of course, is African witch doctor magic, where a smuggler would pay the equivalent of a couple of £100, which is a fortune to them, but to have a spell put on their bag to state that the white customs officer would not be able to spot the drugs inside. And you might have seen the story, one of the officers just opened up a huge Samsonite suitcase that the man could barely carry himself to discover one shirt and the rest of the case full of cannabis, with the guy quite openly saying, you cannot see it. And it wasn't until we'd arrested him and were interviewing him that we found the story that he had actually paid for a spell, the juju, to be put on the bag so that we'd never spot it. Actually, the smell was a giveaway, but...
One imagines. And there are, I mean, so many of these great tales, whether it's drugs, whether it's contraband, living things, are some extraordinary stories. You've got any favourites about some of the absolutely, I don't know, ridiculous things people... I mean, there's a monkey features prominently on the cover of your book. It seems rude not to mention some of those stories. They're pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, the monkey story was a very popular amongst the publisher when I first wrote the book. It was a colleague of mine. We were actually standing on the opposite side of the Green Channel to him, and he'd stopped a guy. We had no idea why. The bloke looked like a normal businessman coming in from Africa. And as he was chatting to him, he was just quietly going through his bag, chatting to the passenger. And what the passenger couldn't see, but we could behind him, and so could the officer searching, was that the overcoat that the man had draped over his bag was now heading for the exit. He had actually drugged a rather large monkey and sewn it into the lining of the coat. And it had started becoming de-drugged after landing, and the monkey had woken up in a black bag, as it thought, and started trying to get out. And of course, this is what made it look like it was heading for the exit. We have that. We'd had very rare bird's eggs, sellotaped to people's bodies. Once opened a bag at Gatwick with a guy that came back from Tenerife. As I opened up the bag, 40 green lizards and geckos flew out in every direction. It took us 2 days to capture what we thought was most of them because they were all over the airport. The man was eventually done by the Environmental Health Services. I think it was close on £5,000 per lizard.
Wow. Pretty amazing numbers. And what happens, John? What's the process? Obviously, you've got rare lizards, drugged monkeys, contraband, drugs, narcotics. What happens to all this stuff, is it? I mean, obviously, presumably with the drugs, this stuff is destroyed, but in some cases it's, you know, taken away and photographed for... photo ops of cack-handed politicians who end up making a mess of things. There's another story in the book. What's the main route for all the different stuff that gets seized?
It's the Queen's. It's on seizure when we, by history, lay our hands upon the goods and seize them. The wording is they are seized on behalf of Majesty the Queen. They become the Queen's property, strangely enough. Everything does. But certain things, if, say, the heroin or morphine importations are pure enough, they will be passed into the medical services to be used medically. Many years ago, we used to do auctions for things such as alcohol, tobacco, watches, stuff like that. Unfortunately, a lot of the smuggling stuff is now fake, so we couldn't ever risk passing that on to the public. But things such as the boats, the houses, the planes, they do get sold on. Some of the boats, planes and houses we'll keep for ourselves to use in the undercover role. But there, I've stood there at incinerators watching millions and millions of pounds worth of heroin going up in smoke. I've stood at a bench smashing Rolex watches with a hammer. You know, we have to get rid of a lot of it. There was a story in there you might have noticed. We'd done a seizure of close on 30 red pepper gas canisters, which come under the Firearms Act, which is not able to import. The officer decided, in charge of the Queen's Warehouse, decided he wanted to destroy them himself and thought it was a good idea if he did it underwater. Unfortunately, forgetting that the gas was lighter than the water and it all bubbled up and the man passed out within seconds. But these things do happen.
John, if we sort of chart the changing landscape, if you like, you talked a lot about drugs. We mentioned, you know, the importation of heroin or cocaine, that sort of thing. But there's kind of grey areas around the margin where it's a bit different. And indeed, quite a lot of changes that happen. We think about something like CAT, where the UK used to have one policy, it's changed, and now it's very different. But CAT in itself is interesting because whilst that was permissible, you know, here in the UK, that kind of afforded you and your colleagues some other opportunities in sort of other markets where it wasn't, didn't it?
Absolutely. We don't always agree with what the government policy is and what changes in the government policy there is. But for us, the CAT being legal in the United Kingdom was a bonus, as it was to any country such as the United States, where it was illegal. Now, I know it sounds strange when you hear it straight away. Producing countries such as Somalia would be shipping the CAT through the UK into the United States, knowing, of course, that we wouldn't touch it because it wasn't illegal in the UK. But what, of course, they didn't realise at the time was we were taking the full shipment details and passing it on to the American authorities. So they could then go off and do their seizures and their arrests and take out the organisations in America. Now, if you stop that, as we did when the law changed, you've lost that intelligence. It's gone. We, by law, now have to take it out in this country. What would happen is the smuggling organisations then shatter, go in different directions, and it would take years to find out their smuggling routes again.
You know, reflecting on that then, also prompts one to reflect on the wider issue about drugs policy, particularly, you know, tolerance and the degree to which you sort of come down on particular people who are shipping drugs and particular drugs themselves. You mentioned the US, they obviously have this famously sort of zero tolerance on a lot of things, the war on drugs as it's known. Is that, and then from what you're suggesting there, is there to a degree to which that's maybe unhelpful and actually to be a bit more enlightened, maybe to be more permissive in some ways, can actually help in terms of the global policing of the whole drugs business? Is that actually maybe a more effective way of going about it in your
view? Well, Tom, I think, saying as an ex-professional at this, I would say we've been fighting an unwinnable war. We will never win. We were having huge success in 2008. We would never stop it, ever. And we have just lost the biggest opportunity to almost wipe out heroin in the world. We just walked away from it without doing anything, and that was Afghanistan. It's amazing to say, but when the Taliban were in charge and Mujahideen in Afghanistan, heroin production hit an all-time low. They were then producing close on 3% of the world's heroin. The second we walked in with the Americans, heroin production increased again, and up to 2 years ago, it was now the biggest producer of heroin in the world. And Afghanistan had never produced so much heroin before. And there we are having a war. There we are in charge of the opium fields, which we could have burnt, but we didn't. Now, I know that the government policy would be the fact that we would be putting so many people out of work, there would be starving children and everything. But which way do you want to go? Do you want to eradicate heroin or not?
But do you think that eradication, is that an objective that's feasible? Whether it's with heroin, if you look to cocaine, the main cocaine producing markets, often in Latin America, can you eradicate or will this always go somewhere else? What should be the objective, perhaps?
Heroin itself, I mean, we call it heroin. Heroin's only a nickname for it. It's a brand name. Dimorphine. If you ever took a heroin case to court, it has to be called dimorphine. Dimorphine users, if they use it correctly and they know what it's cut with, namely mixed with, can live a normal everyday life into your 80s. The danger comes when it starts hitting the streets and unscrupulous dealers start cutting it with everything from brick dust to talcum powder, and we've even found strychnine inside some of the heroin. That's the killer. So really, as a drug, it is quite an acceptable drug to use. I'd probably much rather sit in a car being driven by a heroin user than I would an alcoholic.
Wonderful stuff. Just the tip of an iceberg of amazing stories detailed in Anything to Declare, Searching Tales of an HM Customs Officer. It could be quite a lengthy series written by John Frost, I guess, there. John, thanks for coming to tell us all about it.
Thank you very much.
And that is just about all we have time for on this edition 301 of the Monocle Weekly. Quite a show, Andrew.
Quite a show. Steve Bloomfield was very happy.
He was absolutely made up with his little jingle, wasn't he?
Oh, and most weeks when he comes out of here, if he's done that news look ahead, he's stamping his feet. Why haven't I got a jingle? It's not fair.
I know.
And we've rewarded Tom Edwards that. Has got a whole host of them.
I think he said he wouldn't do it again without a jingle. And we've...
Yeah, he's got one.
We've,
and then
delivered.
He was pleased as punch.
He was. His little face lit up.
I think he's going to be playing that all the time when we're in Lisbon.
I thought you meant just around the place.
No, no.
I think
that'll be the music that plays as he comes
on
stage.
Walk-on music, like a boxer.
Anything to make Steve happy makes me happy.
More happy faces behind the glass, Andrew. Shall we thank our producers? Tom Hall produced the show today. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. And our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And the Monocle Weekly, we'll be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Cheerio.